Ian's remarks sort of anticipated where I was going to start today, because I have two interesting pictures here, neither of which has anything to do with political science, arguably, or international relations, the disciplines from which I come. In 1986, when I was 17 years old, I actually had an opportunity to visit the lab at Harvard University of E.O. Wilson, Edward O. Wilson, the great Harvard biologist and entomologist, who has devoted his life to studying ants and studying insects. And at the time, I was just sort of a secondary school student, and this was a remarkable opportunity to see science practiced up front. And I was there with a family and got a chance to see his ants, and I find myself reflecting some 25 years later that here I am, and once again, ants are informing my thinking about the globe and the global economy. The two pictures here, on the left is a picture of fire ants. I don't know, do they have fire ants here in Australia? Perhaps not. So fire ants are an invasive species in North America. I think they've come from Central and South America. And as I recall, last summer, Australia had a fair amount of unseasonable or very rare flooding in the hinterlands. In North America, we had a fair amount of flooding this spring. And this picture shows some of the fire ants, I believe, in Arkansas or maybe Tennessee, responding to local flooding. And they respond to local flooding by forming a structure or a superorganism whereby they can float. And these ant rafts can endure in water for several days. And it's a remarkable adaptation and learned survival technique that they have developed to solve this very interesting problem of when there's flooding in their ecosystem. And there's been a couple of articles published about this recently. The picture on the lower right is a picture of some floating garbage in the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. You may have heard about the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It is a very large, as the name suggests, floating area of human refuse in the North Pacific Gyre. The North Pacific Gyre is the eddy bounded by Alaska in the north, California in the east, and Japan in the west, in the equator in the south. And this gyre swirls in a clockwise motion. In the middle of this gyre around Hawaii, human refuse from the North American and Asian continents has collected in the ocean. And the size of this gyre is, there are some debates about the actual size of the gyre, but one estimate puts it at about 1.4 million square kilometers, a massive, massive floating area of debris. And this debris has plastics that go down some about a meter or so below the surface of the water. And those plastics are finding their way into the food chain in the Pacific maritime life. And it's a remarkable feature. Obviously, there's all sorts of problems. This is a source of concern. But intellectually, it's a remarkable achievement of humanity. It is the largest human construction ever made. And of course, it's the largest human construction ever made, and none of us intended on creating it. So both of these pictures, again, neither of which has anything much to do with politics or the global economy, suggest the idea of emergence, about how millions of interactions among very simple beings producing very simple decision rules produce remarkable structures that are hard to understand, and they're produced without necessarily design or even intention, and yet they are remarkable in both their geographic scope as well as in their consequence for social life. So, as a political scientist, I've become interested in the sciences of complexity largely through globalization theory. I studied under a prominent globalization theorist at the George Washington University, a gentleman named James M. Rosenau. And globalization is one of these squishy terms that has sort of entered the commonplace lexicon and lacks a certain degree of analytic precision. But when I think about globalization, I like to think about how innovations in communications and technology have really lowered transaction costs for consumers, for firms, and for the full panoply of actors in the global economy. And with reduced transaction costs, actors increasingly are capable of providing collective goods in very creative ways. This has changed the balance between specific and non-specific assets in the global economy. And this has really led to radical reorganization of how firms operate. Obviously, we're well aware of offshoring and outsourcing. And all of these phenomenon that we call economic globalization really challenges political scientists, because when we think about organization as political scientists, we think about the state. We think about the role of government and government in sort of its most Weberian sense, the compelling force of the state and law. We think about the necessity of government to provide public goods. And yet, increasingly, that's no longer the case. Individuals and firms and organizations are capable of providing collective goods without centralized authority, and are able to organize themselves into proverbial ant rafts to provide collective goods in moments of crisis and as well as in moments of opportunity. So this is what ABM helps me start to think about. And I'll talk a little bit about ABM today, but I really want to talk more about the ideas of complexity. We're going to have some examples of ABM here later in the day. I just want to talk about how complex systems theory, or the sciences of complexity, begin to help me think about the global economy and why it is such a complex phenomenon. Complex systems are characterized by the features I have here on the slide. They tend to be massively parallel, characterized by hundreds, thousands, millions, or in some cases even billions of actors interacting independently, in the sense that they're not necessarily following directions. They're following internalized rule models. They might be heuristics. They might be more formalized or explicit rule models. And they're interacting in the absence of centralized control. They're following internal directions rather than external directions. So this very flat, massively parallel organization is nonetheless a form of social behavior that is characterized by interdependent payoffs. While decision-making may be localized and independent, the rewards that actors receive from their decisions may well be interdependent. And we'll talk about some of these interdependencies in a few moments. These systems, these massively parallel systems, tend to evolve, adapt, grow, change, and learn. And they exhibit the remarkable phenomenon of adaptation and learning, even if individual actors do not learn and adapt. So there's this remarkable phenomenon that we're increasingly understanding called collective intelligence, about how systems become repositories of information about the environment, and systems evolve and change even if individual actors in the system themselves do not learn. So it's a remarkable phenomenon. And finally, complex systems is concerned fundamentally with the phenomenon of emergence, that is, irreducible phenomena that arise from the micro-level interactions in these massively parallel systems. And the Great Pacific Garbage Patch is one unfortunate emergent phenomenon. And there are numerous others that we'll talk about today as well. ABM agent-based modeling is a particularly useful tool for studying emergent phenomenon for a number of reasons we'll talk about here in a moment. But first and foremost, it's important to note agent-based modeling is a computational method that's different from an empirical method, a statistical method, or a formal mathematical method. The model itself is a computer program. It is not a statistical or mathematical model or something like that. And agent-based modeling represents these massively parallel systems by modeling not the system as a whole, but by modeling the individual actors in the system. And the individual actors are what we call agents, right? And the power of agent-based modeling is we represent these very simple programs, and the computer itself replicates that program as many times as we require to represent a facsimile of the real-world system. So we can write very simple, small programs that simulate the actions and interactions of these autonomous individuals and rely upon the computer to do the replication of that program to create the massive parallel structure that we observe in real-world complex systems. And the goal of the method is to understand how these localized interactions among individual actors produce these global emergent phenomena, these system-wide processes, and in some case, structures, if you will, that constrain behavior or influence behavior. And so agent-based modelers for a couple decades now have been calling this science from the bottom up. I put social science on there because I'm a social scientist. And what we mean by that is we want to understand the system, but we do so by modeling only the actors at the micro level. The goal is to have the micro level actions produce from the bottom up the emergent structure. So as Ian noted in his introduction, ABM does not compete with other methods. It complements them. It is not intended to replace other methods. So an important question is, well, when is agent-based modeling a particularly useful tool? When is it appropriate and when is it not appropriate? And I've got a number of arguments here that have been put forth by agent-based modelers to say why this is a useful tool. It's particularly useful, as Ian suggested, when the systems we study are characterized by nonlinear cause-effect relationships. As Ian noted, I don't remember who coined this phrase, but oftentimes when we use linear methods, it's sort of symptomatic of the drunkard's search. You know, the drunkard's search is the parable that the drunk is trying to drive home at the end of the night, and he's over underneath the streetlight looking for his keys, when his car is down the road and somebody comes by him and says, well, why aren't you checking near your car? That's probably where the keys are. And he says, well, this is where the light is, right? We search in the areas where cognitively it's easiest for us to solve we think it's easiest for us to find a solution, not necessarily where it's appropriate to find the solution. So linear methods are convenient, they're tractable, they offer some cognitive satisfaction, but they may not always be appropriate, particularly in systems characterized by these highly nonlinear relationships and these sort of systems of equations that cannot be solved mathematically. We'll talk about interaction effects here in a moment, but some systems are characterized by interaction effects, but the essential point now is, in these systems, the effect of variables themselves vary. The variable does not have, if you think about this in calculitic terms, the first order derivative is not a constant. Okay, the variable matters sometimes and it doesn't matter at other times. So interaction effects really confound statistical and empirical methods oftentimes for reasons we'll talk about here in a moment. One of the important points that social scientists have to contend with, that oftentimes the researchers in the physical and biological sciences don't have to contend with, is the difficulties of gathering empirical data. And those difficulties may arise from practical research barriers, costs of gathering data, and so forth. But more often, they tend to arise from ethical research barriers. The example I like to talk about there, the relationship between education and voting behavior is a very complicated relationship that we don't understand very well. We can go out and perhaps conduct some experiments, but as a practical matter, we can't deny people education to see what the effect of a lack of education has on their voting behavior. So there are lots of ethical constraints on the kinds of research designs that we can conduct. And in the social sciences, we tend to rely on natural experimental designs. But in systems characterized by, as we note here, nonlinear cause-effect relationships, interaction effects, and events that are very scarce, we simply don't have sufficient numbers of observations to do appropriate natural experimental designs. My picture here is a picture from the Times of London the day after Lehman Brothers collapsed in September of 2008, at this sort of the pivotal moment in the financial crisis of 2008. Fortunately, financial crises are relatively rare events. They do happen periodically, but they're relatively rare. But wouldn't it be nice if we had hundreds or thousands of examples of financial crises from which we could begin to assess what are the causes and effects of these crises? Well, we don't have a whole partial or large number of empirical observations, but we can simulate them. We can create an artificial world or an artificial financial market to understand those complicated cause and effect relationships. So when events are scarce, when there are difficulties with gathering data, oftentimes computational methods are a better tool that offers more opportunity for understanding the phenomenon than empirical methods would. So we'll talk a little bit more about ABM as the rest of the day goes around, but I really want to spend the rest of my lecture asking sort of a deceptively simple question. Why is the global economy complex? We seem to have some intuitive understanding of what we mean by complex, but I guess the more appropriate question is, why is it so hard to understand the global economy using the conventional methods that we look at, using statistics or ethnographic research or formal mathematical modeling? Why are those tools so limited in their explanatory power? And I'm going to identify four features of the global economy that I would argue give rise to complexity in the global economy. First and foremost is the phenomenon of interaction effects. You can call this interaction complexity. I should note that three of these categories I'm going to talk about were formalized or articulated by Robert Jervis, a political scientist who wrote a book about 13 years ago. And he identified three of these four, and I've sort of added the fourth just on my own intuition. But Jervis started by talking about interaction complexity. And interaction complexity is something that's well known to statisticians. When we do statistical models of certain phenomenon, we note that the value of one variable in, say, a regression model may be conditioned or may depend upon the value of another variable. So the problem is not only the magnitude of effect, but oftentimes the direction of effect. And so variables behave somewhat inconsistently depending on the values of other variables in the systems. So the sort of the cardinal example that I use when I teach my students about interaction effects is in public opinions surveys in the United States. We ask questions about people's views of capital punishment in the United States. And there's a noticeable gender effect. There are differences between men and women and their views on capital punishment. But that difference exists only among African Americans. There's no gender effect among white American voters, but there's a significant gender effect among African American voters. So that's a very simple example of how gender matters for one group of people, but not for another. That's a simple interaction effect. But there are lots of interesting interaction effects that we can begin to think about in the global economy today. You know, one that I think is really quite apparent was during the 2008 financial crisis. And with the rise of the subprime mortgage market, obviously a very, very complicated, a very intricate financial instrument and investment opportunity. But the subprime mortgage market, and particularly the practice of tranching, was predicated on, if you will, an assumption that the risk of mortgage default for any individual lender in one of these packaged mortgages, the risk of default was independent of any other mortgage in the tranche defaulting. So there was the market assumed that default risks were largely independent. And in fact, most of the time, that's true. The risk of any individual defaulting on their mortgage is independent of the risk of their neighbor defaulting on their mortgage. Most of the time. But in 2007 and 2008, suddenly mortgage defaults became interdependent because when I default on my mortgage, that affects the property value of my neighbor. And my neighbor suddenly has a second mortgage and their property becomes stressed. So the interesting question is, why did mortgage default rates become interdependent in 2008 when they had been previously independent? Right. I'm not sure what the answer is, and I think we're working on this, but that's an interesting example of interaction complexity. Some of the more fascinating research that I've seen recently, and this is research that's really come out in the last 4 or 5 years, has really began to question what you might call the standard social scientific model. The standard social scientific model asserts that people's behavior is conditioned by social structural factors, whether that's sociological norms or economic incentives, as well as internal sort of intrinsic motivations arising from their socialization, their values, their beliefs, and so on and so forth. But the standard social scientific model has largely argued that people's behavior is independent of their biology. Well, in the last 5 to 7 years, researchers have started to question that by looking specifically at the relationship between genetics and social behavior. So, how do people's genes interact with their social structural environment? And there have been a number of interesting studies. Nikos Nikolaou and his colleagues did an interesting study on entrepreneurship. And what they did is they did a paired twin study. What they do is they compare the behavior of identical twins to the behavior of fraternal twins. And of course, genetically, identical twins share a genome, whereas fraternal twins only share half a genome, right? They only have about 50% of their genes in common. And these researchers found that identical twins were statistically more likely to correlate on their entrepreneurship, on their ownership and operation of firms, and on their whether or not they were self-employed. They're much likely to be correlated than would be fraternal twins. So there's some evidence that there are heritable traits that affect the business behavior of individuals. I was trying to think of famous twins who can characterize this study on entrepreneurship, and the twins that I came up with were the Winklevoss twins. If you have seen The Social Network, you know the Winklevoss twins quite well. And this picture is doubly ironic because, of course, I think this is a picture taken at the premiere of the movie. So these twins who made a fortune through litigation are nonetheless happy to celebrate their wealth and celebrate the source of their wealth by attending the movie that sort of lambastes them. I just think it's ironic. So that's an interesting I think that's an interesting example of this question about entrepreneurship and genetic factors. In my discipline in political science, there have been a couple recent studies that say there are genetic factors that affect voting behavior and political behavior. So Christopher Dawes and James Fowler at the University of California, San Diego, have done a number of studies that looked at the presence or absence of a specific allele of a gene that governs dopamine receptors. Dopamine is a natural opiate that your brain produces. And the presence or absence of that particular allele in individuals seems to strongly predict their partisanship, the correlation between their party choice and the party choice of their parents. There is a higher correlation of voting behavior, again, among fraternal among identical twins than there is among fraternal twins. Fowler and Dawes found this in a study of twins in the Los Angeles area. And then finally, Peter K. Hatemi and his colleagues at the Queensland Institute of Medical Research did twin studies of Australian twins and has found some correlation among their economic behavior as well. So in areas such as their views and aversion to risk and so on and so forth. So it's clear that genetic factors, we're beginning to understand now that genetic factors actually influence our social behavior. And the presence or absence of genes or particular genes may affect not only our voting behavior and our partisanship, but also our economic behavior and possibly even our choice of profession. And these are all radical challenges to, again, the standard social scientific model, and suggests that we need to start having these conversations among biologists and economists and political scientists and sociologists. Biology itself, or genetic research itself, has begun to embrace the understanding of interaction effects. I should predicate my comments here by saying I know very little about genetics. I only know what I've read from people like Melanie Mitchell and so on and so forth. But it's my understanding that when the Human Genome Project started up 20 or so years ago, the supposition was when we map the full human genome, we will identify a particular gene that causes a particular disease. So the assumption was a particular disorder or a particular malady would be associated with a single gene in the genome. And yet, when they finally mapped the human genome and started discovering this, they realized, well, no, it's single genes don't control single traits. In fact, it's a network of genes, and it, you can think about them as a network of switches working together that determine the presence or the absence of a particular trait or a particular disorder in humans. So genes actually operate as networks. They interact together rather than as single governing entity. And this networked view of genetics has caused geneticists to realize, you know, gee, genetics is much more complicated than we really thought. It's a much more complex system. And this metaphor of switches being in particular positions, on or off positions in a sequence, gets at the core idea of interaction complexity. The presence or absence of a particular configuration of a number of variables working together to produce a phenomenon. And modern genetics, I think, has largely embraced the interaction model of complexity. A second form of complexity that has affected the global economy, arguably, is strategic complexity. Strategic complexity is familiar to most of us as social scientists who have had some exposure to game theory. So strategic complexity, quite simply, is defined here on the slide as the interdependence of payoffs in a system that encourage actors to anticipate each other's actions, to respond quickly. So I'll give you a couple of examples here that I was thinking of strategic complexity. For example, in markets, consumers. Consumers behave differently around holiday sales times than they might behave at a particular year. Consumers know that when the holiday has passed, retailers are likely to change the prices for products that they're offering, so they may delay their purchasing decision. But of course, retailers know this, so retailers respond by making pricing decisions that try to anticipate consumers' behavior after holiday sales. I'll give you another example that was recent. Just last month, the Paris Air Show was held at Le Bourget Airfield outside of Paris. And as you know, the Paris Air Show is one of these grand global events where firms and sign these multi-billion dollar contracts for aircraft. And in the news last week or a couple weeks ago, American Airlines was negotiating with Airbus for a replacement for their narrow-body fleet. But of course, American Airlines was negotiating quite conspicuously. They wanted it to be known that they were negotiating, and of course the reason American wanted it to be known is they wanted Boeing to try and respond with a lower price offer. So it was a form of strategic behavior on American Airlines' part to try and leverage cost concessions or price concessions from aircraft suppliers. And of course, there are innumerable examples of strategic complexity in the global economy. But I'll mention a couple more here. As we see, we've got a couple of pictures here of collective action, people working together collectively to produce perhaps a public good, or maybe in the case of the photo on the left, a public bad. The photo on the left is from the Vancouver riots last month when the Vancouver hockey team failed to win the Stanley Cup in Game 7 of the tournament, and the local fans after the game took to the streets and rioted. Whereas on the right, we have a picture from the Tehran protests in the summer of 2009. And these are examples of people behaving strategically in the sense that people participate in these actions only if they're confident that other people will participate in those actions. So, for example, I would assume if I was an Iranian citizen, I would be highly unlikely to take to the streets and protest the government on my own. But if I was confident that there were others doing so, I would join the crowd and enjoy the anonymity that the crowd offers and the diffusion of responsibility that the crowd offers. Likewise, I'm much less likely to burn a police car on my own than I am if I'm in the middle of a hockey riot. Okay, so people react quite strategically to the behavior of others in ways that are quite important. some of the theories of revolution that came out of the 1989 to 1991 Central European revolutions talked about some very interesting phenomena of strategic complexity. In particular, they looked at a phenomenon that one researcher called preference falsification. And they noted that in authoritarian societies, individuals have an incentive to reveal false preferences. That is, they tend to overstate their support for the regime because authoritarian societies are very good at sowing distrust. They use secret police and informants and so on and so forth to identify dissidents or malcontents or revolutionaries. So individuals have this strong incentive to be insincere in expressing their preferences. And this theory of revolution, this information theory of revolution, was really quite extraordinary because it explained how we could go from a relatively stable society to a revolutionary one almost instantaneously, because it's a chain reaction. When people start sincerely revealing their preferences, just as in the crowds, they say, you know what, I'm not alone. And suddenly you get this cascading chain reaction of the revelation of sincere preferences that creates revolutionary events. So that kind of strategic interaction conveys that people make decisions largely based on their expectations of the behavior or the opinions of others in the system. Here's a couple of interesting examples. I think that's Bondi Beach on the left. There is, the picture on the right is from the state of Colorado in the United States, which is the state in which I grew up. Thomas Schelling was the first to propose a formulation of the minority game as a simple example of strategic complexity. We all love to go to the beach, but we love to go to the beach on a day when nobody else does. We all love to go skiing, but we love to do it on a day when the roads are clear of traffic jams. So there are a whole host of phenomena in social life where, in fact, the incentives are the opposite of the riot, right? In the riot, you want to be in the majority. But on the day you want to go to the beach, you want to be alone. You want to be in the minority. So you try to anticipate people's behavior and do the opposite of what they do. And so that's another interesting example of strategic complexity. And then there's the phenomenon of tactical voting. Tactical voting is prevalent, it's quite common in the UK, and it's been studied most extensively in the UK, largely because of the UK's somewhat unusual three-party system. But there's been this interesting phenomenon in the UK, at least for 20 or more years, whereby Labour voters will sometimes vote Liberal Democrat, or prior to that, Liberal, to punish the Conservatives, to punish the Tories. And to political scientists and even to economists, in a sense, this doesn't make sense. We sort of assume people will always vote for their first choice. Why would you vote for your second choice? Well, it turns out voters say, you know what, my first choice isn't going to win, and the likely winner is my least favorite outcome. So I'm going to vote for the second choice to try and prevent my third least desirable outcome from occurring. I'll vote for the Lib Dems to keep the Tories out of office. So tactical voting is a great example of how voters quite sophisticatedly think about each other's voting behavior and try to affect the outcomes of their choices. A third type of complexity is ecological complexity. Ecological complexity is when actors consciously or perhaps unconsciously and undeliberately change the environment and the payoffs that they receive from the environment. The key idea here is social actors are capable of taking advantage of phenomena in markets such as increasing returns, network externalities, and complementarity of products. They are able to alter market incentives in ways that reward them. So a simple example of ecological complexity, I've got two pictures here that sort of capture this idea. The picture on the left is somewhat unusual. It's a picture of a Caspian Sea sturgeon whose roe is being harvested for caviar. And the picture on the right, of course, is a picture of an Australian wine. Wine and caviar are products where producers quite consciously price their product in such a way to change the incentives for consumption. And in fact, luxury products are fascinating because luxury products are products that are valued more the more expensive they are. So, you know, the French winemakers learned a long time ago, if you price your wine cheaply, nobody's going to buy it, right? Who wants to drink a cheap wine? So luxury goods and producers of luxury goods have long understood their ability to set prices in ways that alter the incentives for individuals to buy them, because nobody wants to buy cheap caviar or cheap wines. That's a simple example, but there are a lot of sort of more complex examples. And thinking back to the Paris Air Show last week, Pratt & Whitney, the American firm that produces aero engines for airliners, Pratt & Whitney has fallen on hard times in the marketplace. They've lost market share to General Electric and to Rolls-Royce and a couple other producers. But Pratt is interested in getting back in the aero engine industry, and they announced a new technology at the Paris Air Show that they believe will allow them to compete back in the marketplace once again. Aircraft producers and aero engine producers are more than happy to give heavy discounts on the purchase of their product, whether it's engine or aircraft. And they're willing to give these heavy discounts and even sell at a loss, because the purchases of those product are, in a sense, committing to a supply relationship over the course of the life of that product. And that supply relationship could last 20 or 30 years. So the great profit for Airbus and for Boeing and for General Electric and Rolls-Royce, the profit comes from the service life contracts that they provide by providing parts and maintenance over the life of the aircraft. But even beyond that, producers deliberately sell at a loss because they realize that the infrastructure that an airline network externalities, or these complementarity of products, can actually create a condition of increasing returns, where once the product is bought, there are incentives for others to purchase that product as well. And this is an important observation. The observation of lock-in in markets largely explains some features of the global economy, including the immensification of firms, the rise of oligopolistic competition, and features like that. I don't know how many of you have iPhones or smartphones. It's kind of strange. Even though I do agent-based modeling, I'm a bit of a technical Luddite, so I don't use smartphones. But here was a fascinating quote from Stephen Elop, the CEO of Nokia, who was capturing this idea about complementarity of products and how that largely changes the rewards that a firm or a consumer receives from from the economic environment. And he was sort of pondering, why is it that Nokia, one of these pioneers of mobile phone technology, has fallen on hard times and lost a lot of market share? And he said, the problem isn't our product. The problem is the network of complementary products that support our phones. He says, we're in a war of ecosystems, because it's not just about our phones. It's about the product producers and developers and advertisers and social network applications that can be supported by our phones. And this is what he meant by a war of ecosystems. You think about these as being a network of interdependent, symbiotic producers whose welfare becomes tethered to each other. And the iPhone is a terrific example of this kind of ecological complexity. This kind of ecological complexity is really apparent, at least in the United States right now, in the burgeoning market for electric vehicles. And in fact, I read a quote sometime within the last week that said, we're at sort of an unusual moment in the automotive industry in the United States, because it's very similar to how the automotive industry was at the turn of the century, at the turn of the last century, when there were many, many competitors developing self-powered automobiles, but they were competing for different models of propulsion for the vehicle, an internal combustion engine, a steam-powered engine, and so on and so forth. And in the electric market, the electric vehicle market, we have this moment where there are different technologies for propelling electric vehicles, but all of them require some infrastructure to support them. They require readily available outlets or particular standards for communication of power from source to vehicle and so on and so forth. And so firms are competing to create the infrastructure that will lock the marketplace into their particular technological standard. And we've got the Chevy Volt on the left. On the upper right-hand corner is a vehicle by Tesla. Tesla is a firm based in Palo Alto, California. It's a very obscure automotive firm, but they make pure electric cars. And then we've got the Nissan Leaf there on the lower right, all using different technology. But they recognize that if they can get some initial adopter advantages, they'll lock the marketplace into their particular standard. Okay, so firms understand the phenomenon of ecological complexity. Networks are characterized by this kind of ecological complexity. Telegeography produces an annual map of global flows on the internet, and they measure flows largely in, I'm not sure what the measure is, kilobaud or something like that. In any case, the map shows, we think of this internet as the internet as being this sort of global amorphous thing. If I want to get a web page for LAN Chile Airlines, or I want to identify a restaurant in Cape Town, I can do so, right? The geography doesn't really matter. But in fact, if you map the flows of data among the geographic regions of the Earth, there are some very distinct patterns of data flow. And you see, in some respects, the centrality of the United States to many of these data flows, not entirely unsurprising given the origination of the internet in the United States. But we see the very sparse flow from Africa to other regions of the world. And the map doesn't do justice to Australia. I apologize for that. Australia is in the upper left-hand, ring there. You can see it, and you can see Sydney there on the East Coast. One of the things that's fascinating about that map is it suggests most of the data flow out of Australia actually goes to North America. Now, the Australian economy, I don't think, is nearly as dependent on the North American economy as this map would suggest. The Australian economy, it seems to me, is much more interdependent with the economies of Asia, and yet data flow seems to be channeled through the United States. So network externalities characterize information and communication systems and transportation systems as well, an important source of ecological complexity. The final source of complexity I would talk about is what I call reflexive complexity. Basically, this is the idea that actors, and this reflexive complexity, I would argue, distinguishes complex social systems from other forms of complex systems, right? Actors in social systems understand and react to shared knowledge about social behavior. So the great sociologist Anthony Giddens calls this the double hermeneutic. He argues that the very act of theorizing about the world changes the world. And in fact, our understanding of social behavior gives rise to the very conditions that invalidate our knowledge about social behavior. It's a real paradox of social science that the natural and physical sciences don't have. So people understand social phenomena, understand emergent phenomena, and are able to react and adapt to that understanding. So I've got a picture here of a bank run, and this is obviously a very old picture. This is from the bank runs in the United States in the early 1930s in the Great Depression. The bank run started occurring, I think, about 1931. And so this is a picture of a bank run. And the psychology of bank runs is fascinating because we all understand the psychology. We all understand that it's a collective action problem. If I just have enough discipline, and if we all just have enough discipline, don't go withdrawing our money, the banks will be fine. And yet, when the banks fail, we all go queue up anyway. Right? So we know the nature of the problem, and we know how people behave, and we anticipate that behavior to try and protect ourselves. A great example of reflexive complexity that I thought about recently, again, comes from the 2008 financial crisis in the United States. This is a picture of Hank Paulson, who, at the time of the crisis, was the Secretary of the Treasury for the United States, sort of in charge of the financial system in the United States. So as the crisis was unfolding in the summer and fall of 2008, the Bush administration and Secretary Paulson were faced with increasingly complicated problems and entrenched skepticism in financial markets about the financial bailout. And Paulson finally got Congress to legislate the TARP program. TARP was the Troubled Assets Relief Program, in which Congress gave the Bush administration $700 billion to help troubled financial institutions, to shore them up, to reinsure investor markets. And Paulson brought together the largest banks of the United States and said, I'm giving you money. And some of the banks said, we're okay. We're not exposed to this problem. We don't need the money. But Paulson insisted that they take it. And the reason that he insisted that they take it has to do with his understanding about how markets work, has to do with reflexive complexity. He said, if I give money only to some banks, that becomes a signal. That signals the markets that this bank is troubled. But if I give money to everybody, the markets can't tell who's troubled and who's not. So it was a great example of his understanding of people's understandings of markets. And he used that knowledge to try and reassure investors. And so for this reason, he forced money. I mean, this is one of those great paradoxes. American taxpayers hate this. He forced money on banks that didn't want it. Banks held on to it, and 18 months later, they just gave it back. But it was quite shrewd of him, because he was thinking about reflexive complexity. Okay, so how does ABM help us do this? Well, again, it allows us to think about those micro-level interactions that produce these emergent phenomenon of interest. Right, we start by thinking about explanations from the bottom up. And one of the things that you'll see in the models that are presented today is that these models are characterized, and these systems are characterized, by learning. These systems are capable of evolving and adapting, and they do so because every complex adaptive system has mechanisms to conserve information, to select good performers, and to encourage innovation. Conservation, selection, and innovation are fundamental features, I would say, of any complex system. And look for those features in the systems that we're going to be talking about for the rest of the day. One business application of agent-based modeling is a new business practice called ant optimization. There are a couple of agent-based modeling researchers in Switzerland who have started a firm, and they use what's called ant optimization. We started off with a picture of the fire ants, and we conclude with a discussion of ants. They use their understanding of ant behavior, and in fact, they use an agent-based model of how ants behave, and they use this to optimize logistics operations for a number of their clients. So Migros, perhaps I'm mispronouncing it, maybe Migros, is a European grocer that has operations throughout the continent. And of course, grocers are characterized by fairly long logistical chains. They have regular deliveries of fresh produce and products, and they have to do so all over the country. So they have a profound traveling salesman problem. You've probably all heard about the traveling salesman problem. Logistically, what's the shortest route I need to take to go to all my destinations? Well, the traveling salesman problem is even more pronounced for Migros, because the problem changes every day. Every day, they have different products that need to be delivered to different destinations. And so they found that they were being woefully inefficient in the allocation of their trucks. Along comes ant optimization, and every morning, this firm looks at the day's delivery, and they unleash their agent-based model, and they say, find us the shortest routes for the trucks. And in about 15 minutes, they have the answer. They send the routes over to Migros, and Migros sends out their trucks. And they've saved an enormous amount of time, an enormous amount of cost on fuel, by using the insights of ants how ants behave to optimize their logistic networks. It's a fascinating example, and there are other applications as well. So I'll conclude with a final thought from John Holland. John Holland, a computer scientist who was one of the pioneers of computational evolutionary computation and genetic algorithms. He had this great quote in a Scientific American article: "Eventually, artificial adaptation may repay its debt to nature by increasing researchers' understanding of natural ecosystems and other complex adaptive systems." And I thought this is a nice quote because it reassures me as a social scientist that it's okay to think about ants, because we do have this debt that we owe to nature and to the insights of the natural sciences. And every time I worry about whether or not agent-based modeling has a home in the academy, I think about John Holland, I think about that quote, and I think about that day when I was 17 and I was in Edward O. Wilson's lab watching those ants walk around, and I think about the journey I've taken. So,
thank you.
Thank you.